The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
This is the Dream Team Tapes, a Diversion Podcast's original series in association with iHeartRadio.
This is the story of the United States Olympic basketball team that won gold in Barcelona in 1992, known worldwide as the Dream Team. Well, we all know what that is. And spoiler alert, the United States Dream Team won the gold medal in Barcelona. But it wasn't as simple as marching to the podium, hearing the national anthem, and waving to the crowd. They did all that, but there was a subplot in between. And I'm going to tell you about that at the end of this, Episode 7 of the Dream Team Tapes, which I'm calling Vive Barcelona, because I, Jack McCallum, had 3 years of high school Spanish. We've been to practices in San Diego, to the gaming tables in the immortal scrimmage in Monte Carlo, and now the Dream Team at long last is in Barcelona, where the world awaits the epic battle between the United States and Angola. Actually, we do remember that battle, though epic it was not, for a reason we'll get into later, and which involves, of course, Sir Charles Barkley himself. There's much to cover in this episode. The attention given to the Dream Team, which will be the hardest thing to describe. The so-called family room in the Ambassador Hotel, where the alpha males Jordan, Magic, Barkley, and Bird played cards all night and argued about championship rings, and where Bird's young son Connor used to roll pool balls loudly down the stairs toward the lobby. There is the frightening intensity with which Jordan and Scottie Pippen faced their meeting with Croatia's Tony Kukoc, who drew their collective ire because Bulls general manager Jerry Krause wanted to pay Kukoc a lot of money, which Pippen felt was being lifted from his pocket. There is the dramatic struggle of the Lithuania team to win the bronze medal. The Grateful Dead had helped fund their unlikely path to the Olympics. And in the Dream Team book, I called Lithuania the tie-dyed darlings. Like many others, I still have my Lithuania t-shirt from those Barcelona games. And finally, after the gold medal was secured by the Dream Team, we had an unpleasant civil war of sorts between the Dream Teamers and USA Basketball. All that is coming. So, Barcelona. For reasons that escape me 30 years later, David Dupree, my closest buddy on the Dream Team beat, a Hall of Fame writer from USA Today, he and I decided to drive from Monte Carlo to Barcelona. This was pre-GPS, remember, and armed only with an unreadable road map and that elementary Spanish, David and I made the 7-hour trip in a mere 10 hours, narrowly avoiding a wrong turn that would have taken us to the Pyrenees Mountains. Credential check-in at the airport was fairly organized, and I said to David, man, this is pretty calm. So when Dave and I separated and I got to my hotel, I thought, you know, maybe I'll take a stroll over to where the Dream Team is staying, which was the newly built Ambassador Hotel, which, by the way, much to the horror of the USOC and USA Basketball, had been a large hole in the ground only a year earlier, But maybe I'll go over to the ambassador, grab a beer with the great NBA PR men, Brian McIntyre and Terry Lyons, grab a quote or two from Charles or Carl Malone, whoever else might be roaming around the lobby, and... But what in the hell was I thinking? 18 months earlier, I had seen for the first time what happened. The crowds that form when we took that photo in Charlotte, North Carolina. I had seen opposing teams stop practicing and start taking photos when the Dream Team came out. So why did I not anticipate the thousands of people who surrounded the Ambassador Hotel, where the Dream Team had checked in several hours earlier? It was chaos. It was bedlam. Thousands of fans, thousands grouped outside the hotel. Dozens and dozens of police, security, men in riot gear. The hotel entrance was cordoned off, and there were barriers set up all over the place. Helicopters flying overhead. The metaphor that usually came to mind, and the one that was written the most, was the mayhem associated with the Beatles' first trip to America in 1964. I remembered I was there. Well, not there in New York City, but I was watching on TV. Here's Dick Ebersol, then the president of NBC Sports, the presenting network of the Olympics, on one explanation of the phenomenon.
I'm not sure the same thing would have happened if the games had been here and they were in Chicago or LA or New York, but that's all. This was Europe, which also had its own, has its own, and had its own love affair with basketball. And the gods of basketball had descended on them, and they never had been there before. And this was their chance to touch them. As you know better than me, Spain is a huge basketball heaven.
In one respect, this level of attention that I can only call pornographic seemed, I don't know, less innocent than the attention given to mop heads from Liverpool. We were well into the age of terrorism. The massacre at the 1972 Munich Olympics was never far from the minds of NBA security, and I learned later there were snipers with Uzis in nearby buildings. Two things about this scene. Number one, it never changed. I kept waiting for the lines, the acclaim, the yelling, the waiting, the anticipation, the longing for the Dream Team. I kept waiting for it to change. It never changed, not for 2 weeks of the Olympics. And number two, as far as we know, there were no terroristic threats against the Dream Team. It went off without a dangerous hitch. The biggest worry for the security people was Barkley's insistence that he would not be constrained from walking around town, particularly strolling along Las Ramblas in the midnight hours. Think of Times Square in the 1970s. That was Las Ramblas. Much has been written about that, including by me, whose final week story of the Olympics was about following Barkley around on that famed stretch of Barcelona nightlife. I know, not a tough beat, right? I'm not going to go into it anymore. Google Barkley and Las Ramblas, and you can probably spend the whole day reading. Later on, I did get inside the Ambassador Hotel from time to time. I interviewed Magic and Chuck Daly there. I saw the players' kids running around, peeked into the private player sanctum, which in the Dream Team book I referred to as the coolest room in the world, which I'll talk about soon. Now, the night after we got to Barcelona, Dupree and I went out to dinner with Carl Malone. I was surprised the extent to which Carl was not pleased about the famed pickup game in Monte Carlo. He just did not like all the jive trash-talking, and he did not like Magic kind of co-opting the team as he saw it. Yet when David and I asked about getting a photo with the Dream Team, the mailman quickly said, "I'll ask Magic. He's our captain. He handles all that kind of stuff." I found it interesting that Malone, no fan of Magic, so quickly acknowledged that Magic was the boss for that kind of stuff. Now, about that photo request, on the list of people in the entire world who under normal circumstances would be reluctant to request a photo with athletes, I would be second most likely. Most likely would be Dave Dupree. Yet he had the idea, and I quickly said okay. It was an indication of what that summer of the Dream Team was like, how special it was, how special we knew it would continue to be. We did indeed get that photo taken under mortifying circumstances, that story to come. The next day, 2 days before the Dream Team's first Olympic game on July 26, the team members trooped in for one of the most entertaining press conferences I've ever attended. For one thing, most of the international journalists began applauding as soon as the team walked in. That doesn't happen in America, though Donald Trump would certainly like it to. Questions were all over the place. One of them from a journalist who had apparently never seen an NBA game and asked a question that can be summarized as, sometimes you make a basket that's worth 2 points and sometimes it's worth three. To which Karl Malone responded, that's just the way we do it, my man. So many times in subsequent years, I'll answer an unanswerable question the same way. That's just the way we do it, my man. It was out of this press conference that one of the most immortal Olympic lines was uttered by Charles, the one you heard about Angola. The weird thing is, for years myself, and almost everybody, thought that Charles said, I don't know nothing about Angola, but Angola's in trouble. But he didn't. He actually used correct English. I don't know anything about Angola, but Angola's in trouble. I'm not sure why it was so funny, but it was, and remained so. Mike Wilbon, the great ESPN commentator, used to call Charles up from time to time and just leave a message. I don't know nothing about Angola, and just left it there. There was an alternate theme going on in Barcelona before the games, a theme that contrasted with the devotional manner with which the Dream Team was treated by adoring fans who camped out outside of the Ambassador Hotel. It was this theme. These damn millionaires are messing up the Olympics theme, echoed by many of the poobahs in the USOC and a few IOC officials. At first, it centered on, hey, they're not even staying in the athletes' village, something that had been made clear 2 years earlier when open competition was established. Everybody knew that Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Larry Bird ain't gonna bunk with nobody, and they ain't sharing a communal bathroom. Jordan could have bought the entire Olympic Village with the money he laid out on a casual Nassau bet on the golf course. Then word filtered out that most of the Dream Team would not attend the opening ceremonies. Though several of them wanted to, it was thought to be way too chaotic. Word got back to NBC Sports President Dick Ebersol, I've referred to him before, who sprung into action and moved heaven and earth to deliver the Dream Teamers to the Olympic gate just minutes before they had to walk in. Everybody else had to get there 3 hours earlier, and that was just not going to fly. It was like magic. And magic did come. And in fact, if memory serves, the only ones who did not come were Jordan, who was still afraid of potential mauling and who had enjoyed the ceremonies back in 1984, and Bird, who was thinking only of his back. Now, exactly what everybody feared would happen, happened. Upon spying the Dream Team in a procession, athletes from all over the place broke ranks, ran over to the players to take photos, grab autographs, or just genuinely hang on. I can still see in my mind's eye a diminutive gymnast from somewhere jumping up to touch Magic and David Robinson. It was a splendid scene, and it spoke to this reality. As much as the Dream Team drew attention away from the other athletes, most of them loved it. They loved being in the same arena with these guys. It was a kind of transfer of importance to it. The objections came for the most part from the executives, the bureaucrats, because that's usually where objections come from. Okay, time to play game one, Angola. The hundreds of journalists who had come to Portland knew what to expect about the result, but there was still an air of anticipation before the game. Actually, I made that up. I didn't feel anything. But then someone made it interesting. The elbow thrown by Barkley on an Angolan player named Herlando Coimbra was so unexpected that not many people saw it, and they certainly didn't know why it happened. And no, the officials did not throw Barkley out. When I interviewed Charles for the book in 2011, he still insisted that Herlando Coimbra, the Herlando Coimbra, had it coming.
It bothered me that people didn't understand what happened that night. You know what? They started a full-fledged brawl like the next game against Spain.
Charles, please. Here's Jordan on the subject of Charles's elbow.
The only other game that I can remember that, you know, that really stood out was idiot Charles Barkley. He was such an idiot. When we played Angola.
Yeah.
These guys were in total admiration of us to ask for autographs before the game. And in the first quarter, he hit the guy with the elbow. This dude, man, was in total admiration of everything we did. We killed him by 40. I don't know. It wasn't even a game. At any point in time,
you guys had a 46-1 run.
46. It wasn't even close. And he hit the guy with the elbow. I'm saying, well, but that was his way of trying to intimidate. They intimidate when they ask us for the autograph at the beginning of the game.
It's comic relief now, but it was a certified big deal then because of this ugly American tag that had been attached to the Dream Team in some quarters. What happened eventually, though, is that Barkley actually became the team's biggest ambassador. Not just the team's, the entire United States Olympic delegation. He was out in public, he attended events, he worked the crowd, he shook hands with other athletes, and most of all, as I said before, he became a Pied Piper on Las Ramblas, well into the morning hours.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Now, the Dream Teamer's second game, which was against Croatia, was just as memorable, but for an entirely different reason. It became widely known as the Kukoc game. At the time, Bulls general manager Jerry Krause was so intent on signing the young Yugoslavian star Toni Kukoc, who was a multi-talented 6'10" left-hander, that he had refused to extend Pippen's contract because he wanted to save money to offer it to Kukoc, whom he had selected in the 1990 draft. That was not going to fly. Pippen, with the help of Jordan, decided they would absolutely destroy Kukoc, who had no idea what was coming and was at any rate distracted by the imminent birth of his son, which in fact did occur a couple days after the Kukoc game. There were two things that every single Dream Teamer mentioned to me in the separate interviews I did for the book. The first was the unlikely Harry and Larry relationship between Ewing and Bird. The second was the Kukoc game. Now, you have to understand the backdrop. To an extent, the Dream Teamers were tired of non-competitive basketball. Their lifeblood was competition. And as fun as it was to play together with great players, they missed the taste of a real challenge. Straw man though he might have been, Kukoc represented a real challenge. Here's Magic remembering Jordan and Pippen before the Croatia game.
But I tell you, Michael and Scott were so ready for that Croatia game.
Yeah.
They were like, look, I don't want no help. I'm going to shut them down. And we were like, wow, they are so focused. And it made us all get focused because they really wanted to stop Tony.
And here's Jordan himself on the Kukoc game.
Pippen and I said, we're not going to let this fucking get passed out. Because Kraft was giving him so much credibility ahead of what we just earned in terms of us, championship. And he's saying, well, we don't want to hear that. We want to hear what we've done, not what, what Tony Kukoc is going to bring to this team. I mean, we won without Tony, in a sense, and yet all you can talk about is Tony. So he created that enemy or that concept, and our focus in the Dream Team was, okay, when we play Croatia, Yugoslavia, we're going to shut down Tony Kukoc.
The funny thing is, Jordan and Kukoc, who eventually played on the Bulls 96, 97, 98 three-peat, became really good friends. Much better friends than Jordan and Pippen are. They play a lot of golf together and even shared victory in that noted event called the Michael Jordan Celebrity Invitational. They also shared many a laugh about the Kukoc game. Harassed unmercifully by both Pippen and Jordan, Tony finished with 4 points and the U.S. won 103-70. Now, the splendid team defense played by Jordan and Pippen was a subject offered up by several Dream Teamers in interviews I did for the book. Here's Larry Bird.
The amazing thing for me through that whole Olympics was with Michael, every team we played, he guarded the point guard, was putting pressure on the point guard. Now, I'm just sitting there watching him, and they would turn him, and either Scotty or somebody would come, and the kid would panic. He just throw the ball over his head, and we just run in there and just intercept every pass. Just the pressure that this guy was putting on these kids was just unbelievable.
Was there ever a better backcourt duo on the defensive end than Jordan and Pippen? Jerry Sloan and Norm Van Leer, back with the old Bulls, not quite. Will we ever be talking about Kawhi Leonard and Paul George in that way? Don't think so. And when I talked to Pippen about it, his face lit up. It was one of the few areas where you could make the argument that he was almost as good as Jordan. And I would make that argument. Now here's Rod Thorne, the NBA executive who was deep on the inside of most Dream Team decisions, talking about how much Coach Chuck Daly depended on the two Chicago Bulls Dream Teamers.
When the assistant coaches would talk about who would start the next game, he would always say, give me Michael and Pippen.
Now, you can never fully divorce Jordan from offense, of course, but the primary reason Daly felt that way was defense. Maybe there would be one game when the jump shots weren't falling. Maybe Magic and Bird would be looking particularly old. Maybe Ewing and Robinson would get in foul trouble. Maybe Charles had been out too late on the Romblis and wasn't quite in the mood that night. But Daly knew that Jordan and Pippen would put everyone in a defensive vice grip and it just wouldn't matter. Nothing else would matter. As the games went on, a 111-68 win over Germany, a 127-83 romp over Brazil. No word on whether or not Oscar Schmidt got Bird's autograph, but he did get 24 points. The man could shoot. The focus of the Dream Teamers became more and more what was called the family room in the Ambassador Hotel. Kids play room by day, family room in the evening hours, and a cigar smoking, beer drinking, balls breaking cauldron of testosterone from midnight on. Everyone drifted in and out from time to time, but the principals were Jordan, Magic, Pippen, and Barkley, with memorable cameos from Bird. Ewing, too, was part of the in-crowd on the ultimate in-crowd team. That happened largely because of his long history with Jordan. They first met as teenage scholastic stars, and they were teammates on the 84 gold medal winning Olympic team, and his sudden new friendship with Larry Bird. Ewing, the Harry of Larry and Harry, talks about it.
I grew up in Boston. I hated the Celtics, and I hated Larry Bird in high school. In high school, I thought he sucked. Then I got to the NBA. I called all my friends back in Boston. I say, look, all this shit we were talking?
Oh, he's good.
This motherfucker right here is the truth. This man can play.
I love that quote. This motherfucker is the truth. Ewing, by the way, thinks that it was Jordan who came up with Harry and Larry. There's 1,000 stories that came out of the room. One of my favorites is little known. It involves the wife of C.M. Newton, one of the USA basketball executives, a lifelong college guy who started out reviling the idea of pros taking over the Olympics, but ended up a Dream Team convert. I wish I had CM's voice for you to hear, but the tape of my interview with him is scratchy. Anyway, he describes the afternoon that his wife, Evelyn, a very proper wife of a proper man, in an effort to improve her video game skills to play with her grandchildren, sat down and partnered with Patrick Ewing's young nephew, Michael. Predictably, Mrs. Newton played poorly, and she apologized to Michael. "That's okay," Michael told her. "We'll get those motherfuckers next time." She happily reported to her husband, feeling like now she was in the in crowd. Evelyn died in 1999, and CM died in 2018. Well, they always had the video game in Barcelona. The storylines that evolved from the coolest room in the world ran predictably through Jordan. His endless, boundless, superhuman energy. His endless appetite for ball busting, particularly about championships. And finally, the refusal of Magic Johnson to accept that Jordan was now king of the hill. Here's Bird.
Michael was the best player in our league before that he started, 92. I had no problem. You know, we had our run. You know, I had my run. My run was over. And my run was over a couple of years before that. I think Michael really handled himself very well over there. But we was up there one night, and we were talking, and I just said, "Patrick, you got to be out of your mind if you think you can still compete with this guy. I mean, there's no fucking way. There's no way you can compete. He is by far the best player in our league, even though we have great players. Let it go, man. Let it go."
It was a reprise, of course, of what had started with the greatest game nobody ever saw. And Magic finally had to admit there was a new sheriff in town. It was hard to go at the relentless Jordan. Barkley tried. And please remember, these are Barkley's words.
"Oh, he's so damn black. And he's not the best looking guy in the world. Like, my favorite thing was, I hear all these fucking women talking about Michael Jordan's good looking. If Michael Jordan was a fucking plumber, he wouldn't be good looking. Any guy got $500 million look good."
Repeat, these are Barkley's words. And here's Ewing on Jordan's proclivity to talk trash.
"You know, Michael has been talking trash from the first day I met him. We were both 17. I'm visiting North Carolina, and he was already there. That's the first time I ever met him. And he was talking trash that day, and he has not stopped. He has not stopped."
No matter who cracked on who about what, Jordan always brought it back to championships. And remember that he had only won two at this point. Four more were to come. Bird had three. Magic, the leader in the clubhouse, had five. No one else on that team had any, and only two other Dream Teamers, Drexler with the Rockets in 1995 and David Robinson with the Spurs in 1999 and 2003, would ever get one. This is Barkley.
"It always starts out with good ribbon. We crack it on each other, good locker room humor. You can always tell when you're getting under their skin. And it really was just Michael. You know, he's such an asshole sometimes. Like, when you start cracking on Michael, because he don't want people, like, it's hard to crack on everybody else. But when you start cracking on him, his line is, you ain't never fucking won anything."
It was that winning thing. Remember what I said, Magic, not Jordan, was the leader at that point so far as championships won. And that led Magic to repeatedly challenge Jordan's primacy as the best player in the game. That invariably drew Bird into the conversation. And here's Jordan talking about Bird and Magic and who was king of the game from a memorable night in the coolest room in the world. Jordan's obvious affection for Bird comes through in this clip.
"The one time I felt like he stood up to Magic saying, 'Hey, would you just shut up and just, you know, let's just ride off into the sunset.' And he had about 12 to 13 beers, you know, and the most relaxed I've ever seen my Bird. I never knew he was that type of a witty type of person. Never thought he relaxed. I never thought, you know, he was pretty honest, brutally honest about, you know, how he foresaw the game and the players at that time and taking himself out of it. You know, and allowing me and Pippen to step in and say, 'Okay, you guys are better than we are. You know, you're better offense, you're better defense.' He gave out those types of rewards, but Magic would challenge him."
Now, the one area where Magic never challenged Jordan was in the area of energy expended. I could do an hour podcast on Dream Team teammates talking about Jordan's superhuman, RoboCop, million-dollar man level of energy. Remember that the Dream Team always played the late game, So on game nights, they never got back to the hotel until well after midnight, at which point the card game began.
We play all the way to almost 6 in the morning. See, I'm in it, so nobody can tell me. I'm in it with this man. He would go upstairs, stay for an hour, hour and a half. He would meet whoever he was going to play golf with. They'd go out at 8 o'clock. Now, we just left at 6. He would go play, they say, 18 holes, sometimes even more. Come back, take a nap for, what, 2 hours, 3 hours. We get on the bus and go play the game and then do the same thing the next night. And then I was telling him, man, I'm getting tired because I was not used to this, right? And no, MJ, you can't go to sleep. I was like, man. So I said, man, you are unbelievable to be able to, and then go get 20 points in the half, first half. Like it was nothing. Like, I was like, wow. I, when I'm out speaking to groups, and I tell them these stories, they be like, wow, they can't believe it.
The one time Jordan's hardly get any sleep at all routine really freaked out Chuck Daly was before the Lithuania game, the semifinal game. Daly really respected Lithuania's two best players, Arvydas Sabonis and Šarūnas Marcelionis, and Jordan had gotten very little sleep and had played golf on game day. Well, then again, his playing partner had been Daly, so really, how much could the coach complain? The final score of that Lithuania game, 127-76, was probably the Dream Team's most devastating performance. Daly managed to get everyone substantial minutes. 9 Dream Teamers had 10 or more points, led by Jordan with 21. But his scoring wasn't the main thing. At one point in the first half, Daly told Jordan to really go after Marcelionis, not let him get the ball, disrupt the Lithuania offense, and turn this thing into a rout so everybody could relax and he could put a lot of players in the game. That's what Jordan did. And for years later, Chuck used to talk about it. I really wish I had his voice saying it, but I don't. But here's what he said. For 6 minutes, Michael did not let Marcelionis get the ball. He couldn't even get the damn ball. I heard that over and over from Chuck. Every time I saw him, I would deliberately bring up the Lithuania game. He wouldn't even let him get the damn ball. Now, this seems like a great time to talk about Lithuania, which could be the subject of a podcast series on its own. Memo to self, look into that. Actually, Lithuania was the subject of a great documentary called The Other Dream Team. Try to check it out. In the briefest terms, the Lithuania team, like your high school band or your local Cub Scout troop, had to raise money to even qualify. The country was ravaged by a Soviet invasion just weeks before the Lithuanian team had to begin qualifying for the Olympics. Yes, there were great players in the country who had formerly played for the national team, particularly Sabonis and Marcelionis. But this was another level of pluck and determination. The team was coached by Donnie Nelson, son of Don, who we know eternally as Nelly. And Donnie never got a penny for coaching Lithuania, and he got understandably choked up by his association with these guys.
There was something going on here that was deeper. You know, I almost felt like, I really felt like I was in this time capsule, and instead of, you know, George Washington and Paul Revere, and I really felt like, you know, I grew up in Boston, so I knew all the history and all that kind of stuff. So I almost felt like this little republic was doing the same thing that the colonies did 200 and whatever years ago, you know.
Marcelionis was, by the time of the 92 Olympics, solidly entrenched as an NBA player for the Golden State Warriors, coached by Nelly. The Warriors beat writer at the time, the late, great George Shirk, wrote a piece about how Nelly Jr. and Šarūnas were going around collecting $100, $200 a shot by making speeches. Now, the Grateful Dead manager read it and said, yeah, man, we can plug into this. We're like into peace and freedom. I'm paraphrasing here. Now, the memories of Nelly Jr. and Marcelionis diverge on this point as to when they actually met the dead. Nelly said it was in San Francisco. Šarūnas says it was at a concert in Detroit. But their memories of the, let's call it the ambiance, was exactly the same.
Well, you went to a dead concert in Detroit?
Yeah.
With Donnie? them.
To see that? To,
yeah, to see them, to talk to that Rex Foundation guy, yeah.
Okay.
So that was interesting. Smell interesting.
I don't know whether you could understand or not, but Sharuna said there was an interesting smell. I'm sure there was. Now, the Dead never gave as much money to the Lithuanian team as was advertised, maybe a couple grand. But they did give proceeds of the sales of the distinctive tie-dye Dead Skeleton logo t-shirts. And it was the prize souvenir from the 92 Olympics. I think I mentioned this earlier. I still have mine. The Lithuanians wore it on their warm-ups. Coolest warm-ups ever. Several hours before the U.S. played for the gold medal against Croatia, the absolute best game of the basketball tournament took place. Lithuania's bronze medal game against the unified team, which was basically the Russian national team. Lithuania playing against the representative of a country that had sent tanks into its streets a year earlier. It was incredible, as was the game. Lithuania won 82-78. Sarunas and Sabonis were monsters with 29 and 27 points, respectively. Nobody that I ever saw played harder than those two played in that game. And I will never forget something Marshall Onis told me when I interviewed him for the Dream Team book in 2011. I wish I had his voice on tape for it, but I don't. He said that he remembers showering after the game and not really being able to enjoy the moment. Here's my impression of what he said. The thought that we could have lost that game was stronger than the thrill that we had won it. Wow. The United States never had those kind of stakes when they went into a basketball game.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed, and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, at last, the gold medal game for the Dream Team, Croatia. It wasn't another Kukoc game. To be quite honest, it wasn't much of anything. None of the usual gold medal tension. The U.S. was going to win. There was only one bit of suspense. It had nothing to do with the game. But before we go there, remember I told you about this photo request that had been made through Carl Malone? David and I had heard nothing about it, and it was all but forgotten, which was fine with me. But suddenly, before the damn gold medal game, NBA photographer Andy Bernstein approaches Dupree and me and says, "Hey, we're going to take a photo of you guys when they come out." "Now?" both Dupree and I say. So we get these special passes, hurriedly go back, meet the Dream Team as they're coming out for the gold medal game. They're shouts of, "Let's go, let's get it done," when all of a sudden Magic says, "Hold up, guys," and nobody knows what the hell is going on. And Dave and I creep into place, and Andy aims his camera. And from the back row, I hear Bird make an X-rated, joking comment, "Good God." And then they move on. Just another night with another photo with another couple of schlubs. I still have the picture. Along with an embarrassed grin, I'm wearing shorts and some kind of Hawaiian print shirt and look like I'm heading for a barbecue where they're going to be playing Jimmy Buffett all night. The photo isn't much, but I still have Bird's joking comment ringing in my ears, and I use the line early in the Dream Team book. Years later, I brought it up to him, and he says he doesn't remember saying it. Just another well-aimed insult in a long line of them. The U.S. beat Croatia for the gold, 117-85. Jordan was great, but no greater than Drazen Petrovic, the Croatian guard who finished with a game-high 24 points. Ah, Petrovic. He was the Magic Johnson of Yugoslavia, possibly the Magic Johnson of all of Europe. He was great. He was fun to watch. He was combative. He was cocky. I loved him. And on June 7th, 1993, about 10 months after he won silver for Croatia in the Barcelona Olympics, he was dead. Petrovic was a front seat passenger in a car driven by his girlfriend when it plowed into the back of a truck on a rain-drenched section of the Autobahn in Bavaria. He was killed instantly. He was 28. 100,000 people attended his funeral in Zagreb. 100,000. Now, there was never, ever a podium ceremony like the one for basketball in Barcelona in 1992. It wasn't as iconic, and it really wasn't as important, as the one in Mexico City in 1968, when Tommy Smith and John Carlos held up black glove fists to signify their protest against racism in America. But it was strange. First, out came the Lithuanians wearing their tie-dyed warm-ups in clear violation of Olympic podium rules. They were told no tie-dyes, only official podium wear, to which Marcelonis, the captain, basically said, "F you," or however you say that in Lithuanian. "The dead believed in us when we were nobody," he said. "The friend of the devil is a friend of mine, man." What you thought we'd get out of here without a dead lyric? Croatia came out, overjoyed with the silver medal, and then it was the Dream Team, three of whom came out with American flags draped around their shoulder. The TV commentators noticed, but honestly, I'm not sure how many in the crowd did. This had been brewing for a while. Were the Dream Teamers affiliated with Nike going to wear the USOC-mandated Reebok podium jackets? Incredibly, the issue had not been settled, even though it had been talked about for days and days. Here's Jordan.
"Look, you know, I don't want to be a part of this Reebok experience because I'm with Nike. I have my own business. I've been tired of Nike, and it's a disrespect to Nike." They said, "Don't worry about it. We will figure that out when the time comes." And then come, we win a gold medal, and they come in and says, "You guys got to wear the uniforms. If you don't wear the uniforms, you can't stand up on the podium." And I'm saying, "That's not fair. Because now if I don't, I'm not standing up on the podium, I look, you know, I'm dissing America, you know, because I see business bigger than the experience of being, you know, standing up there and winning a gold medal," which is, I never wanted to be put in that position, which is one of the reasons why I initially said to, you know, to Dave Gavitt and to, you know, Rob Thorne and to all the guys, I said, you know, this is not going to work because of the business that's tied into this. And I don't want to disrespect my companies. I don't want to disrespect what's happening with, you know, with the USOC. They assured me that that was not going to be an issue.
At least three different people tell me it was their idea to get flags to drape over the shoulders of the players to hide the Reebok logo. Jordan said it was his. He asked Tom McGrath, a USA basketball official, to get a few flags from the stands. Tom did. Whose idea was it? I don't know. And who cares anymore? The disagreement was petty, and the players took some crap for it. But really, was the USOC any less to blame? The Reebok warm-up jacket was a business transaction for them, just as Jordan's loyalty to Nike, which had been ongoing for 8 years by then, was a business transaction. There were no virgins in L'Affaire Podium. But who came out looking good to those who even noticed? Jordan, Magic, and Barkley, who were the three players who wore the flags. Why, look how patriotic these guys are. They're wearing the American flag. There were some moments I remember about the podium, the national anthem, a tear coming from the eye of Chuck Daly, who always, always stayed in the background. Harry and Larry, Ewing and Bird exchanging high fives, Barkley blowing kisses, Malone putting his arm around Clyde Drexler. Jordan and Clyde, mortal enemies under normal circumstances, chatting and pointing into the crowd. And Magic Johnson, a man who was supposed to be dead, pumping his right fist, then his left fist, then taking Barkley in his arms. And then it was over. The Dream Teamers won a plane back home within 90 minutes of winning gold. As I wrote in Dream Team, the lights dimmed, the Palau Municipal emptied, workers picked up trash, and it was like the day after your birthday, when the world seemed a little less bright, the fine edges of joy scrubbed flat. But it wasn't the end of the story, not by any means. Reverberations about the Dream Team continued back in America, and to an extent, they continue today. I'll talk about that in the eighth and final episode of the Dream Team Tapes. Thanks for listening.
If you enjoyed the Dream Team Tapes, please follow, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. The Dream Team Tapes is written and hosted by Jack McCallum. Executive producers, Mark Francis and Scott Waxman. Executive producer for iHeartMedia is Sean Tatone. The Dream Team Tapes is a Diversion Podcasts original series in association with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.